This is the listening part of your Year 12 exam in English. It will consist of three tasks. You will hear the texts twice. Task 1. You have a minute to read the task.
I'm happy to talk to you, Matt. I've been watching your YouTube channel for maybe about 6 months now. Could you briefly just introduce what your YouTube channel is about?
Yeah, well, initially my YouTube channel was really focused on just how to learn Japanese because I, you know, spent 5 years pretty much fully dedicating myself to studying Japanese and I had pretty good results. And as time has gone on, it's kind of spread out to more than just learning Japanese and kind of more just language learning in general.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny that I came across your channel because I don't study Japanese and I've never studied Japanese before, but I do study Korean, and I think that a lot of the content that's on your website and on your YouTube channel is applicable to anybody studying a foreign language. So yeah, Matt, your Japanese is very impressive. I was wondering if you could just talk about why you started to learn Japanese. What was your initial motivation to tackle this language?
Yeah, well, I gotta say, it wasn't the purest of motives. When I first became interested in Japanese, I was just, you know, 16 years old. I was a high school student, and I got into watching anime, just really liked how the language sounded. I thought it was really cool. And also, I wasn't so popular at my high school, and I think somewhere deep down, kind of subliminally, I thought, hey, maybe if I go to Japan, I'll be really popular. And I think that was part of my motivation initially.
So it's really cool that you started learning Japanese in the USA, right? It wasn't like you moved to Japan and then started. This was a completely foreign language to you when you started.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I spent, like, I had a year or two where I was kind of just studying the way that, you know, most people try to study a language, like buy a textbook, go to class, and didn't really make that much progress. And then I came across this website called All Japanese All the Time, which was written by this guy who claimed to have gotten fluent in Japanese in just 18 months while living inside of the United States. Wow. And he did it with this crazy method where he tried to immerse himself with Japanese as close to 24 hours a day as possible. Actually, I showed a video of him speaking Japanese to one of my Japanese friends, and my Japanese friend told me that he was legit. And so I was like, okay, let me give this a shot. And I started trying to replicate his process. And so the first 6 months of doing that, I was inside the United States. And then I went to Japan for 6 months for study abroad during high school. And then I came back and I've been in the United States ever since.
Do you think your age was a factor learning so young? Like, I started learning Korean when I was maybe 24 or 25.
I think it was a factor in the sense of I had very little, like, responsibilities and obligations.
Yeah.
And so that made a huge difference. I mean, when I was able to do study abroad, that basically allowed me to just study Japanese literally all day because I had... When I was living in Japan, I wasn't actually receiving credit for the classes I was taking at Japanese high school because I didn't understand most of the material. So, so really, it was kind of almost like a six-month vacation in Japan where I just got to study all day. And so, of course, that's not feasible for most people who have a life. Yeah, I think it's important to, you know, compare yourself to who you were yesterday, right? Like, really don't try to compare yourself to other people on the internet or other friends you have, but try to be realistic about, like, how much time it's possible for you to put in day to day and try to slowly improve over time and try to slowly find more cracks in the day you can fit in and try to just incrementally improve over time.
Totally. I completely agree with you there.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
I'm happy to talk to you, Matt. I've been watching your YouTube channel for maybe about 6 months now. Could you briefly just introduce what your YouTube channel is about?
Yeah, well, initially my YouTube channel was really focused on just how to learn Japanese because I, you know, spent 5 years pretty much fully dedicating myself to studying Japanese and I had pretty good results. And as time has gone on, it's kind of spread out to more than just learning Japanese and kind of more just language learning in general.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny that I came across your channel because I don't study Japanese and I've never studied Japanese before, but I do study Korean, and I think that a lot of the content that's on your website and on your YouTube channel is applicable to anybody studying a foreign language. So yeah, Matt, your Japanese is very impressive. I was wondering if you could just talk about why you started to learn Japanese. What was your initial motivation to tackle this language?
Yeah, well, I gotta say, it wasn't the purest of motives. When I first became interested in Japanese, I was just, you know, 16 years old. I was a high school student, and I got into watching anime, just really liked how the language sounded. I thought it was really cool. Mm-hmm. And also, I wasn't so popular at my high school, and I think somewhere deep down, kind of subliminally, I thought, hey, maybe if I go to Japan, I'll be really popular. And I think that was part of my motivation initially.
So it's really cool that you started learning Japanese in the USA, right? It wasn't like you moved to Japan and then started. This was a completely foreign language to you when you started.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I spent, I had a year or two where I was kind of just studying the way that, you know, most people try to study a language, like buy a textbook, go to class, and didn't really make that much progress. And then I came across this website called All Japanese All the Time, mm-hmm. which was written by this guy who claimed to have gotten fluent in Japanese in just 18 months while living inside of the United States. Wow. And he did it with this crazy method where he tried to immerse himself with Japanese as close to 24 hours a day as possible. Actually, I showed a video of him speaking Japanese to one of my Japanese friends, and my Japanese friend told me that he was legit. And so I was like, okay, let me give this a shot. And I started trying to replicate his process. And so the first 6 months of doing that, I was inside the United States. And then I went to Japan for 6 months for study abroad during high school. And then I came back and I've been in the United States ever since.
Do you think your age was a factor learning so young? Like, I started learning Korean when I was maybe 24 or 25.
I think it was a factor in the sense of I had very little like responsibilities and obligations.
Yeah.
And so that made a huge difference. I mean, when I was able to do study abroad, that basically allowed me to just study Japanese literally all day because I had when I was living in Japan, I wasn't actually receiving credit for the classes I was taking at Japanese high school because I didn't understand most of the material. So really, it was kind of almost like a 6 month vacation in Japan where I just got to study all day. Wow. And so, of course, that's not feasible for most people who have a life. Yeah, I think it's important to, you know, compare yourself to who you were yesterday, right? Like, really don't try to compare yourself to other people on the internet or other friends you have, but try to be realistic about, like, how much time it's possible for you to put in day to day and try to slowly improve over time and try to slowly find more cracks in the day you can fit in and try to just incrementally improve over time.
Totally. I completely agree with you there.
There is half a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task one. Go on to task two. You have a minute to read the task.
Is it possible to learn how to be happy?
We know what people should be doing to be happier. So I thought, well, let me just develop a class on this stuff.
This stuff was the curriculum Professor Lori Santos taught in her course, Psychology and the Good Life. And it's not just that some students wanted to learn the secrets to happiness. It became Yale's most popular class ever.
At Yale, the professors don't know in advance how many students are going to take the class. And so I walked into class thinking, you know, it's going to be really small. But in the end, just under 1,200 students ended up taking the class, which wound up being just around one out of every four or five students at Yale.
Where did you put them all?
That was a bit of a struggle. The first class we taught in a chapel, which fit about 800 students, but then that overflowed. And then we wound up teaching the class in the university concert hall, which was a little surreal to be a professor who expected to be teaching in this tiny seminar room to be on stage in a concert hall filled with over 1,000 students. It was a little crazy.
Happiness is an elemental human desire, yet we often struggle to achieve it. This is why there's no shortage of self-help books, motivational talks, and well-being apps on offer. There are a lot of us searching for better ways to maneuver through a stressful world. Is it really possible to teach people how to be happy?
This is a question I get a lot, actually. Happiness should just be easy. It should just be the thing that emerges from our activities. But one crazy thing about our mind is that our minds are not all that well designed, frankly. This frustrates me to no end as a cognitive scientist. We have all these intuitions about the kinds of things that would make us happy. You know, we think more money would make us happy and all these different accolades at work. My students think that better grades would make them happy. And all of those intuitions, it turns out empirically, are just wrong.
When Professor Santos was appointed head of one of Yale's colleges, she was struck by how much more anxious and depressed the students were than those she remembered from her student days. And this isn't just a phenomenon of this highly competitive university. Nationwide, U.S. statistics paint a similar picture. Her course is now available free online to the general public. The aim is not to teach people to be happy all the time. That isn't really possible or even desirable. But to give people a better understanding of what does and doesn't make them happy. All backed up by research from the growing field of positive psychology. The strategies she advocates, like meditation and gratitude journals, sound deceptively simple to me, but Professor Santos is certain their benefits can affect our whole lives.
We often think of happiness as this ephemeral thing, but how happy we are is shaping how we're going to react to events for years to come. I mean, that's the amazing thing, years to come. There's research suggesting that how happy you are in your 20s will start predicting your income level when you're in your 30s and 40s. Like, causally, like your happiness that I measure, even at 12 years old, is going to predict your income in your 30s, which is crazy. There's also evidence suggesting that your happiness levels, particularly your mood, will affect how you react to some sort of negative event or how you'll react when you experience negative life events. So we think of happiness as this ephemeral thing, but really what it is it's a set of moods that come from a set of practices that deliver us some resilience against the yucky stuff in life.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
is it possible to learn how to be happy?
We know what people should be doing to be happier. So I thought, well, let me just develop a class on this stuff.
This stuff was the curriculum Professor Lori Santos taught in her course, Psychology and the Good Life. And it's not just that some students wanted to learn the secrets to happiness. It became Yale's most popular class ever.
At Yale, the professors don't know in advance how many students are going to take the class. And so I walked into class thinking, you know, it's going to be really small. But in the end, just under 1,200 students ended up taking the class, which wound up being just around one out of every four or five students at Yale.
Where did you put them all?
That was a bit of a struggle. The first class we taught in a chapel, which fit about 800 students, but then that overflowed. And then we wound up teaching the class in the university concert hall, which was a little surreal to be a professor who expected to be teaching in this tiny seminar room to be on stage in a concert hall filled with over 1,000 students. It was a little crazy.
Happiness is an elemental human desire, yet we often struggle to achieve it. This is why there's no shortage of self-help books, motivational talks, and well-being apps on offer. There are a lot of us searching for better ways to maneuver through a stressful world. Is it really possible to teach people how to be happy?
This is a question I get a lot, actually. Happiness should just be easy. It should just be the thing that emerges from our activities. But one crazy thing about our mind is that our minds are not all that well designed, frankly. This frustrates me to no end as a cognitive scientist. We have all these intuitions about the kinds of things that would make us happy. You know, we think more money would make us happy and all these different accolades at work. My students think that better grades would make them happy. And all of those intuitions, it turns out empirically, are just wrong.
When Professor Santos was appointed head of one of Yale's colleges, she was struck by how much more anxious and depressed the students were than those she remembered from her student days. And this isn't just a phenomenon of this highly competitive university. Nationwide, U.S. statistics paint a similar picture. Her course is now available free online to the general public. The aim is not to teach people to be happy all the time. That isn't really possible or even desirable. But to give people a better understanding of what does and doesn't make them happy. All backed up by research from the growing field of positive psychology. The strategies she advocates, like meditation and gratitude journals, sound deceptively simple to me, but Professor Santos is certain their benefits can affect our whole lives.
We often think of happiness as this ephemeral thing, but how happy we are is shaping how we're going to react to events for years to come. I mean, that's the amazing thing, years to come. There's research suggesting that how happy you are in your 20s will start predicting your income level when you're in your 30s and 40s. Like, causally, like your happiness that I measure even at 12 years old is going to predict your income in your 30s, which is crazy. There's also evidence suggesting that your happiness levels, particularly your mood, will affect how you react to some sort of negative event or how you'll react when you experience negative life events. So we think of happiness as this ephemeral thing, but really what it is it's a set of moods that come from a set of practices that deliver us some resilience against the yucky stuff in life.
There is half a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 2. Go on to task 3. You have a minute to read the task.
Now, Linda, what do emojis add to communication?
Well, certainly what we found in our lab is that people report that they're a really good way to enhance an emotional tone within a text message or on Facebook and things like that. So certainly it's a way of adding an extra element of emotion that is more difficult to portray in written language. And as well as that, there's the role of how emojis can help reduce ambiguity in messages as well. So particularly if you're trying to be sarcastic, for example, in a message so as not to offend the recipient of it, you might use a wink emoji, for example, just to ensure that the intended meaning behind the message isn't ambiguous.
Yeah, that sounds like a really important addition to language. On their own or sort of in combination, do they really form a part of the language? How do we distinguish between what's language and what's just a smiley?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the key, is actually looking at them in conjunction with language. I mean, if you think about the context of, say, a text message conversation, you might see the odd emoji cropping up as a response in itself without any written language there. So like a crying with laughter emoji in response to what somebody might have said. But in terms of them as a language in themselves, that's quite difficult to kind of identify, because I don't think you could have an entire conversation just in emojis. I mean, you could try, you know, challenge accepted. So looking at them in conjunction with language is important, but we tend to assume that they have more of a nonverbal function.
Yeah, can we say anything about the way our brain interprets emojis, or the way we interpret it when we see an emoji? Do we know anything about that area of the science?
We know a little bit. There has been some research that's been done. It was looking at emoticons rather than emojis, so the actual textual punctuation that forms, you know, the facial features rather than the yellow icon things. And this research actually used fMRI to actually look at brain activation for participants who were looking at sentences that included emoticons and those that didn't include emoticons. And what you find is actually there's different activation in the brain that goes on. So when people are looking at sentences that include emoticons, actually some areas of the brain light up that tend to be more associated with nonverbal functions, which don't seem to light up when just reading sentences without them. So this, from that kind of a neurological perspective, there's certainly something to say about how the kind of processing of them does have some kind of nonverbal function. But actually at the same time, the verbal functions also light up. So they're actually kind of in between. They're probably serving a dual purpose for verbal and nonverbal communication, which I know is kind of interesting to pin them down, really.
Yeah, I really like the idea that emojis are sort of the hand gestures of the written world. I mean, does the use of emojis affect how we perceive someone? I think often we think of it as a sort of simple way, or perhaps we think of them in a derogatory manner. I mean, how do we perceive people when they use emojis?
Well, that's a good question. That's something we've been looking at quite a lot in our lab. And when we look at whether people are using emojis on Facebook, for example, particularly what we found is when people use smiley emojis, other people who've never met these people before, they're just making a first impression by looking at their Facebook page. So it's kind of interesting that something as simple as just using a smiley emoji seems to have some relation to what other people perceive other people to be at a first impression basis. Those perceptions might be very different if those emojis were being used on an email, for example, because we know there's an awful lot to be said about when and why you might be using them, who you're using them with. Facebook's a kind of informal, kind of social environment, so using emojis on there isn't necessarily deemed such a bad thing. It's kind of a socially acceptable thing to do. So it's interesting that we see those findings.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
Now, Linda, What do emojis add to communication?
Well, certainly what we found in our lab is that people report that they're a really good way to enhance an emotional tone within a text message or on Facebook and things like that. So certainly it's a way of adding an extra element of emotion that is more difficult to portray in written language. And as well as that, there's the role of how emojis can help reduce ambiguity in messages as well. So particularly if you're trying to be sarcastic, for example, in a message so as not to offend the recipient of it, you might use a wink emoji, for example, just to ensure that the intended meaning behind the message isn't ambiguous.
Yeah, that sounds like a really important addition to language. On their own or sort of in combination, do they really form a part of the language? How do we distinguish between what's language and what's just a smiley?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the key, is actually looking at them in conjunction with language. I mean, if you think about the context of, say, a text message conversation, you might see the odd emoji cropping up as a response in itself without any written language there. So like a crying with laughter emoji in response to what somebody might have said. But in terms of them as a language in themselves, that's quite difficult to kind of identify, because I don't think you could have an entire conversation just in emojis. I mean, you could try, you can, you know, challenge accepted. So looking at them in conjunction with language is important, but we tend to assume that they have more of a non-verbal function.
Yeah, can we say anything about the way our brain interprets emojis, or the way we interpret it when we see an emoji? Do we know anything about that area of the science?
We know a little bit. There has been some research that's been done. It was looking at emoticons rather than emojis, so the actual textual punctuation that forms, you know, the facial features rather than the yellow icon things. And this research actually used fMRI to actually look at brain activation for participants who were looking at sentences that included emoticons and those that didn't include emoticons. And what you find is actually there's different activation in the brain that goes on. So when people are looking at sentences that include emoticons, actually some areas of the brain light up that tend to be more associated with non-verbal functions, which don't seem to light up when just reading sentences without them. So this, from that kind of a neurological perspective, there's certainly something to say about how the kind of processing of them does have some kind of non-verbal function. But actually at the same time, the verbal functions also light up. So they're actually kind of in between. They're probably serving a dual purpose for verbal and non-verbal communication, which I know is kind of interesting to pin them down, really.
Yeah, I really like the idea that emojis are sort of the hand gestures of the written world. I mean, does the use of emojis affect how we perceive someone? I think often we think of it as a sort of simple way, or perhaps we think of them in a derogatory manner. I mean, how do we perceive people when they use emojis?
Well, that's a good question. That's something we've been looking at quite a lot in our lab. And when we look at whether people are using emojis on Facebook, for example, particularly what we found is when people use smiley emojis, other people who've never met these people before, they're just making a first impression by looking at their Facebook page. So it's kind of interesting that something as simple as just using a smiley emoji seems to have some relation to what other people perceive other people to be at a first impression basis. Those perceptions might be very different if those emojis were being used on an email, for example, because we know there's an awful lot to be said about when and why you might be using them, who you're using them with. Facebook's a kind of informal, kind of social environment, so using emojis on there isn't necessarily deemed such a bad thing. It's kind of a socially acceptable thing to do. So it's interesting that we see those findings.
There is half a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of Task 3 and the whole listening test.